It's Wednesday, March 25th, 2020. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is the Pen Pod, a limited-run podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, victory, a federal judge says Pen America's lawsuit against President Trump for retaliating against reporters can move forward. Then, remembering playwright Terrence McNally, who died yesterday at 81 from complications of coronavirus. I'm Stephen Fee, all that coming up on the Pen Pod. Just yesterday, a federal judge in New York ruled that Pen America's lawsuit against President Trump can proceed. We sued the president in October 2018 for using the powers of the presidency to attack the press. To bring us up to speed on the case, our very own Nora Benavides, director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at Pen America. Hey, Nora.
Hey, Stephen.
So quickly walk me through this here. What are we accusing the president of doing in this suit?
Sure. Well, we sued him over a year ago for his retaliation of the media. He has a history of trying to kick reporters out of press briefings and generally deny access for the media to report on critical issues. So we're seeing him try to exact reprisals. That's sort of one of our phrases that we use all the time. But what it really means is just silence the media. And he's doing that in a number of ways. And so our lawsuit we brought over a year ago trying to hold him accountable for that.
And obviously we're a free expression group. We believe in free speech. I mean, the president can say nasty things about members of the press all he wants. But what is it exactly that we think he's doing that's crossing a line?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that we're worried about is that the press is increasingly limited in what they're able to cover now. And of course, the president has a First Amendment right of his own to say what he wants, to have his own opinions. But members of the media have a First Amendment right to have access to those types of press briefings and to be able then to convey and report on those for the public. So Pen America members like Jim Acosta, Brian Karam, Dana Milbank, those are all reporters that we have seen become targets of the president's efforts to stifle their access. So it means they're being affected and our other members are being affected by this.
And with Jim and Brian and some of these other journalists, I mean, their press passes were actually taken away, right?
They were. They were taken away. And generally, we've seen the president trying to do this, especially targeting members of the media whose coverage he dislikes. We're seeing now in the middle of the coronavirus briefings, only limited members of the media able to even have access. And at a time when we need this more than ever, we're very concerned, but we're thrilled by the order, is the truth.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of surprising happening. I mean, while all of this stuff is happening, when we filed the suit, obviously we would have never known that we would reach the critical point that we have. You know, what is it about this decision coming right now that maybe makes it particularly poignant?
Well, unfortunately, I feel like we're on the brink of just an absolute economic, existential, even public health crisis, as everyone knows. And we're all online all the time, needing information, needing access to what reporters are telling us. And they're the front lines right now. And we need their voices. We need their reporting more than ever. And so it really comes actually at a critical moment for us to elevate the importance of a free press.
And finally, what does this mean for the First Amendment and the president's relationship to it?
Well, one, I just want to thank the court because I think that the order that we received is a victory for the First Amendment. I think that it is a rational, reasoned order. And what we're seeing is that where we have legitimate claims on the legal side, the court upheld that. And so what does it mean for the First Amendment? It's all wonderful. I think we all should begin moving forward with the belief that we have the right to use speech and that our reporter members, like Brian, like Jim, that they represent some of the best in trying to exercise and hold dear those cherished rights.
So what happens next? This was just a ruling. Is the next step that it goes to trial?
I would love for that to be the case. I think we are a little far out from that. We're moving into what's called a discovery phase. And so we're going to be requesting documents from the government. And we're going to find out what they're doing related to how their decision-making has been formulated on the president's side, why certain journalists have been targeted. And I honestly cannot wait. It's going to be very exciting.
That's Pen America's own super lawyer, Nora Benavides. She's director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at our organization. Thanks a bunch for joining.
Thanks.
And now, remembering playwright Terrence McNally, who died yesterday at age 81. He was among the first in the literary community to succumb from complications from coronavirus. For more on McNally's life and career, Jesse Green, co-chief theater critic at the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, Jesse.
Thank you, Stephen.
So, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Ragtime, Masterclass, how do you define the work of Terrence McNally?
Well, McNally's work was generally about outsiders, people trying to get into something that they felt they had been excluded from. And they were often gay, but they, when they were gay, they were also stand-ins for the outsiderness everyone feels, maybe even especially right now, you know, when the world is not the world that you thought it would be. So, for example, in Ragtime, you've got groups of African Americans and immigrants trying to find a way in a new country. And mm-hmm. in Spider-Woman, you've got a political prisoner and a prisoner of homophobia sharing a jail cell. And in Masterclass, you've got Maria Callas, who, you know, as a young woman was told she was too ugly and too unmusical ever to be seen on an opera stage. He championed people like that, although I should say never unequivocally.
You know, you write in his obit that his first Broadway production was a bomb called yeah. And Things That Go Bump in the Night, but it featured a romance between two men. What did McNally's work, or how did McNally's work reckon with gay life in particular?
Well, I should just add, by the way, that I didn't put it into the obit, but the two men were, you know, one was that at that time, that new kicky thing called a bisexual, and the other was what they then called a crossdresser. So he was, even McNally was at that time partaking in some of the, you know, aren't they crazy kind of normalizing effect that some plays did in their treatment of gay characters. But over the longer arc of his career, his treatment of gayness followed the arc of the times, from the closet to liberation to disaster to marriage and parenthood. In one of his last plays called Mothers and Sons, A gay man has married and they have a 5-year-old son together. So again, you know, this was not done unequivocally in that play, Mothers and Sons, where the mother was played by Tyne Daly, by the way. She's a furious old homophobe, but she's not unlovable. And the young gay dad is totally right on the politics, but he's a bit of a pill. the other thing to say, though, is that he didn't just dramatize, you know, the change that I'm talking about. He helped to make it stick by sharing it with a very mainstream audience. He wasn't writing for a niche audience. He was acculturating and teaching a commercial Broadway audience. So if his plays sometimes seemed ingratiating, that was why. It was on purpose.
Yeah. You also write about one of the first shows McNally saw, which was the musical Annie Get Your Gun. What impression did that have on him and his career?
I think the impression it had was to make him realize that theater could change things. Could change minds. I mean, and you know, Annie Get Your Gun is not a profound piece of work politically, but it still would, you know, it literally rewired his own brain. So that decades later, the scenes he saw, the way Ethel Merman turned her hand or warbled a note, was as fresh to him as when those things were first encoded in his neurons. So I think it taught him that he could do something in the theater that few people have an opportunity to do, which is to change people's minds forever and literally.
And maybe that segues to my last question. How do you think Terrence McNally will be remembered by the theater and literary community here in New York and globally?
Well, one thing, just speaking personally, I met him a number of times. I interviewed him now and then. I knew his husband, Tom. So one thing I think is that people who knew him or knew of him in the theater will remember him as an incredibly generous and lovely guy who actually lived the change he was writing about. He wasn't just, you know, reading a history book and trying to make it seem real. He had been through it. His parents were totally unaccepting of his relationships. They didn't want to hear about it. And yet, you know, after years of problematic relationships, including famously for 5 years with Edward Albee, he married a wonderful man who eventually became the producer of his plays. So another thing I think he'll be remembered as, aside from, you know, this incredible body of work, 30 plays, 35 plays, maybe 36, 10 musicals, 4 screenplays, for opera librettos, will be as an example of a way to live as an artist in kindness.
Well, Jesse Green is a theater critic at the New York Times, helping us remember the prolific Terrence McNally. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Stephen.
And that's our episode for Wednesday, March 25th, 2020. Join us tomorrow for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at Pen America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Sign up on our website for our Daily Dare newsletter, where we track major stories about literature, free expression, and the news of the world. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is the Pen Pod. See you tomorrow.